Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Around Kendall Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts, they'll tell you straight up, this is where American drug discovery occurs. Nowadays, it's where a global spotlight shines on scores of labs that are mixing, tweaking, testing COVID vaccines. In a notorious sports capital, which this is, the vaccine race to save the species, no less, is a sort of fix for the COVID eclipse of big league football and baseball excitement. Tom Brady gone forever. No fans allowed in Fenway Park. DNA science, meantime, has become a prize local industry. The pharmacological startup called Moderna, breaking ground in RNA therapies, figures in national news every day and in street chatter too. Mind you, this vaccine race in our focus this hour is not pure science. It's science married to money in huge federal research outlays, also big jumps in stock values, and dreams of a global market for cures still to come. It's not wide open to inspection either. Nobody pretends to know all that is going on, and a lot of informed skeptics think the vaccine race stumbled out of the gate. So this radio hour is a conversational sampling on a mystery in motion. We begin with two esteemed Boston doctors, Aaron Kesselheim and Jerry Avorn, both hands-on internists at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. They're policy wonks, too, and they moonlight as reporters and commentators for the New England Journal of Medicine, which is read all over the world. I asked Dr. Jerry Avorn, for starters, if he would take himself or inject in his patients the vaccine that Operation Warp Speed is looking for.
Based on the information that we have, or even that we're likely to have by November 3rd, it's not a vaccine that I would want to yet be taking. That doesn't mean that we're not going to get there. But treating this as if this was a horse race, and then having this arbitrary date of before election day that the president keeps focusing on, is really problematic, because we're not going to know enough about side effects before we have a lot more thousands of person months under study. The side effects we worry about the most are going to be the ones that maybe occur in every 3,000 or 10,000 people, and it's going to take a while to find them. But if you have a vaccine that's taken by 100 million people or more, then something that occurs even rarely could be a public health catastrophe, since we're talking about giving this primarily to healthy people. So I'm not expecting that any vaccine will be ready for prime time from my perspective, either to recommend it or to take it anytime before Election Day.
Speak of that 1 in 10,000 risk. I mean, it's an infinitesimal chance. At the same time, it could be an utter disaster, and it could disqualify a vaccine, right, if it killed 1 in 10,000?
The issue about our tolerance as a society for side effects is very different when you're talking about a drug to treat a disease that somebody already has. But if you're talking about giving something, by definition, as a vaccine to hundreds of millions of healthy people, the tolerance for rare side effects really goes way down, because most people who get infected by COVID are either going to be asymptomatic or have a mild case, or certainly in a much smaller number can have a horrible disease and die from it. But your willingness to incur a rare side effect is much lower than if you're treating somebody who's already got a disease. And if you do the math, 1 in 10,000 people, if you give that to 300 million people, then you've really got a very high incidence of a pretty bad event.
Aaron Kesselheim, would you vaccinate one of your patients? Would you vaccinate yourself with anything underway, anything that could be used before Christmas, say?
I certainly would vaccinate myself and my patients with some of the vaccines underway if, in fact, the data come out and they are clear that it appears that the vaccine is very effective in preventing COVID-19, and if the side effects are manageable. So to me, it just depends on the rigor of the data. And I think it's almost impossible sitting here in September to assuredly say that those data will be out and be analyzable by December 25th or, you know, November 3rd.
If the evidence is ambiguous or even only slightly promising, one thing the government can do, the FDA can issue a so-called EUA, Emergency Use Authorization. Some people are very concerned that the Trump administration will insist on it, even go into production itself through the Defense Production Act with a vaccine that hasn't satisfied everybody. How's to judge that?
It's not like you need to be terribly paranoid or cynical about this. We have, in the last couple of months, seen two very embarrassing emergency use authorizations that the FDA was pressured to issue, one for hydroxychloroquine, in a sense implying that it worked when it didn't, and then, to their embarrassment, having to withdraw it because the drug was not only ineffective, but also not, you know, free of side effects and risks. And then a couple of months after that, doing the same thing on FDA's part for convalescent plasma. You know, the idea that if you take blood plasma from someone who is recovering from COVID and you inject it into people who have COVID, that it might help them. They also needed to walk that back when it became clear that there was not compelling evidence that it worked. So we've now got two emergency use authorizations by FDA, whether under political pressure from the White House or not, that turned out to be wrong and had to be walked back.
Looking beyond November and the big picture generally, so many disconcerting questions out there, but I'm thinking, first of all, the FDA standard, always quoted, is safe and effective for drugs and vaccines. But in the case of a global pandemic, it leaves out absolutely critical questions like, will the vaccine also be accessible to vast numbers of people who need it? Will it be affordable? And in the case of a global disease that travels on its own, is the vaccine going to be available everywhere?
That is an important thing to worry about. You know, when the FDA approves a product, it's only saying that the benefits appear to outweigh the risks. You know, I think we all know that just because a product is FDA approved doesn't mean that it gets fairly to the people who need it, to the people who are at highest risk for COVID-19. And we also, as a society, need to think about not only making sure that the vaccine is evaluated fairly, but that we also address issues such as affordability and access, in particular because taxpayers have made such a substantial investment in the development of COVID-19 vaccines over the last 6 months, both in the underlying research and in the cost of clinical trials and in setting up guaranteed purchase markets through the government.
Who told me that that basic October flu shot we get every year, dutifully, is only about 50% effective, for example?
Well, I think a better way to say it, Chris, is that only about half of people who get the flu shot are protected by it. And again, that's not a bad statement about the flu shot. It's a great thing and everyone should get one. But when we talk about even a great vaccine like the flu shot, it only works, depending upon the year, in 40, 50, 60% of people. You should still get it. But the idea that we're going to have a vaccine that in some superpower way is going to make people never get the disease is simply not borne out with most other vaccines that we've now got.
There's a mythology about vaccines and a story, and it's not just Donald Trump. We all have it in our heads that we come up with some terrible thing like smallpox or Spanish flu, and it does terrible damage, and then government money maybe and some good smart companies and scientists go to work on it, and they fix it, and we get a vaccine, and we live happily ever after into a sort of Hollywood sunset. How does it actually work?
I think that it historically works like that a little bit. It historically takes longer than 2 hours plus credits to wrap up the story. And I just think that that also gets back to this whole, you know, focus on the, you know, certain deadlines as we need this by this deadline or that by that deadline. You know, unfortunately, science and biology don't always work on those deadlines. And sometimes in order to make the right decision and the best decision, you need to take a little bit more time.
And Chris, the other side of the kind of Disney version of vaccine development that you're referring to is the dark side. I mean, when was the last time any of us heard somebody say, I just came back from the doctor and got my HIV vaccine or my malaria immunization? I mean, people have been trying for decades to come up with a vaccine for HIV and for malaria and for a wide variety of conditions, and we haven't been able to. It's not because the people working on it aren't incredibly smart. It's just that the idea that you need to have a vaccine, so you throw a lot of money at it, and you develop a Manhattan Project, and you give it a great name for marketing, and then you get a vaccine. It doesn't always work out like that, and there are many diseases for which, infectious diseases, for which we've not yet been able to discover a vaccine. I think the public needs to be ready for the fact that either the vaccine will work only partially, or that it may work at the cost of side effects, or that it may be a real disappointment. I mean, I'm hoping none of that is true, and I'm hoping we'll get a really great vaccine, as in the Disney version of it, but that does not always happen. And the idea that we'll be able to, quote, open up the economy as soon as we have the vaccine is scarily simplistic.
Aaron, main elements of a new system for the next virus.
We actually did have a system in place. We had a plan for addressing a pandemic. And when President Trump came into office, he threw that plan out and he disbanded the group. So I think that it's funny that we're thinking about, gosh, where can we start over, when the next pandemic comes along, when we actually had a plan in place that was disregarded in the context of the current pandemic. But I mean, I think that what, you know, a proactive plan for the next pandemic looks like is, first of all, a lot more central authority as it relates to public health goals and cooperation and coordination between the federal public health planning and the state public health apparatuses. I think it looks like an independent FDA that is more insulated from political pressure and the concerning influence that we've seen the political actors have on the great work of the FDA scientists. I think it means a better system for communicating with people and doctors and patients about ways to behave to reduce risks of infection. You know, I think it means continued investment in pandemic responsiveness, not just investment when the pandemic starts to flare, but investment in the intermediate times, and then, you know, making sure that that public investment is then made, you know, the outcomes of it are transparent so that everybody can benefit from them. But I think that we need, you know, some kind of sustained investment in trying to, you know, make sure everybody is ready.
Doctors, thank you. Aaron Kesselheim and Jerry Avorn, both at Brigham and Women's, both deep in the vaccine race. Coming up, how the rules have changed since the golden age of vaccine research after World War II. This is Open Source. Among medical doctors we're meeting who will be on the front lines of administering a COVID vaccine, there's something disorienting about the speed, the politics, the uncertain standards in the race to get there. Dr. Rebecca Weintraub does internal medicine at Brigham and Women's, and she runs the Global Health Delivery Project at Harvard Medical School. She says there is something wrong with the scope of this vaccine project, and she hears it from her patients.
Many of our patients ask us if their family members can be first in line for the vaccine. As their concern grows, if they transmitted the virus to their own loved one who is caring for them, for example. And then obviously, we've also gotten questions from our patients, are we vaccinated? How are we ensuring that we are not transmitting as we're caring for those in the inpatient setting?
Your colleagues, the other doctors, Kesselheim and Avorn, said they're nowhere near seeing a vaccine that they would take themselves. How about you?
I would agree that the data to date is insufficient for me to advise myself or a family member. I do think the clinical trial data will be public. We'll be able to be aware of it. And I am optimistic that there will be a safe and effective vaccine that will feel comfortable advising our patients and our family members. And we ourselves will become vaccinated in the short run.
How do we extend the vaccine questions to cover the globe? And do we not have to?
If we start with the notion of what is a pandemic, it's global transmission of a novel virus, it predicates that we actually have long-term global solutions to establish long-term immunity to the virus. And right now, there's a tremendous effort for non-pharmaceutical interventions, community mitigation, masking, routine testing. But in order to decrease or eventually, we hope, stop transmission globally, a global distribution of a vaccine will be a necessity.
Should that be written into the specs like It's got to be safe and effective and global.
You know, I wish, Chris, people had thought through that as we started seeing bilateral agreements between nation states and pharmaceutical companies. So this level of direct procurement from a nation to a company has led to and propagated vaccine nationalism. I will procure doses of the vaccine to cover my population. That is a political barrier, not based on an epidemiologic model of transmission.
That's an interesting phrase, vaccine nationalism. Who defends it and how?
Well, this is actually not a new tactic, a nation-first strategy. So we've actually seen a very similar set of tactics when the World Health Organization declared H1N1 as a pandemic in 2009. So several companies initiated vaccine development, and we knew that there would be a scarce availability of a vaccine. Specifically, Australia, Canada, and the U.S. actually bought up all the existing supply for their own citizens.
Rebecca Weintraub, would you argue that the world deserves a global vaccine, or equally that for us to be safe, there's got to be a global vaccine?
Well, Chris, I'd actually add a small caveat to your question.
Please.
We have a vaccine portfolio right now of first-generation vaccines. So of the 200 vaccine candidates, there are about 7 different types of vaccine platforms that they emanate from, several which have never produced a vaccine before. For example, the mRNA platform. And I hope we don't think of this as a singular vaccine, because there's just a tremendous science that we can gain from of investing in multiple vaccines. We have to de-risk the investment in the portfolio.
I've heard that before, that the more vaccines that work, the better. Is that true?
Well, in this situation, since we are able to structure the novel virus so quickly that it's not mutating, it's quite a stable virus to investigate and to begin running the clinical trials. What a bottleneck we'll face is we can only run worldwide so many phase 3 clinical trials simultaneously. So yes, it's tremendous to have a diversity. Are the right candidates actually making it through to a phase 3 trial and receiving billions of dollars in public dollars for their clinical trial investments? That is unclear if the selection of the portfolio has been based on the promise of the science versus the politics of leaders at bay.
Thank you, Rebecca Weintraub. Dana Brown in Washington is a public advocate watching the drug industries. She runs the Next System Project, looking for alternatives. The telltale problem today, she says, and it wasn't always so, is an industry habit of treating diseases of affluence with daily doses of profitable drugs, statins, for example, neglecting acute needs of poor people threatened by infectious diseases. She explains why vaccines are precisely not attractive investments for the for-profit drug companies.
No single company on the planet has anywhere near the manufacturing capacity necessary to produce a vaccine at scale for a global pandemic. We're in an interesting predicament of modernity here in terms of the development of medicines, and particularly vaccines and medications for infectious diseases, which have, you know, long been the single biggest killer of humans, right? The single biggest public health problem has been infectious diseases for most of modern history. But the way we develop and market medicines now has really kind of seen infectious diseases squeezed out of the list of priorities for pharmaceutical companies, bringing us to a particularly difficult moment in history that we're all living right now.
Dana Brown, spell it out, this problem of modernity in drugs, in vaccines, in modern medicine, in the tech side of medicine going forward. And the COVID experience, I have a sense, is going to lay down a lot of precedents, build a lot of fortunes, point a lot of ways. What's the problem?
One of the things that's been fascinating as somebody researching the pharmaceutical industry and the development of the sector over the last decades is to understand more and more how recent it really is that we do drug development the way we do right now, and that we confer 20-year-long monopoly-type patent protections to new medications, and the very interesting incentives that this creates for an industry to really only produce the most profitable drugs, which tend to be things for chronic diseases, right? Something you'll need to take every day or once a week for the rest of your life. Diseases of affluence, right? And diseases that affect people in developed countries. But we see a massive decline over the last 40 years in vaccine development and in the development of new antibiotics and things like that. And this really has to do with the laws and regulations that have allowed for a system in which there is a lot of profit to be made. There's a lot of intellectual property that private actors can claim, but based on a massive shore of publicly funded research that really underpins the whole industry. And I guess what to me has been so shocking is how new all of that is, right? That this was not the way that medicine in general and the development of new medicines happened even in the 20th century, right? The first half of the 20th century, there was a lot more cooperation, openness, and a lot of drug development was done almost entirely in the public sector, especially vaccines. The U.S. military is largely responsible for the development of half of the vaccines that came about in the 20th century.
We keep hearing that the problem with vaccines is you just need it once to save you from an illness and you'll never use it again. Overstating a bit, but that creates a special problem of financing vaccines. Is that true?
Well, again, it's very interesting that we think of that as a problem now, right? From a public health perspective, we think of that as a massive plus, right? If you can vaccinate a population and assure that you don't have millions of deaths or, you know, people disabled by a disease or dropping out of the labor market because they've been infected by a disease that presents a bunch of complications, right? This is actually a massive savings for the world. So thinking of vaccines as a problem is also a new way of thinking. In capitalist terms, yes, they're not the moneymaker. They're not very functional as market goods. They require a massive upfront investment. Those investments must be steady and long-term to produce successful and safe vaccines. And then when they work well, as you say, people use them once or maybe once every 10 years, something like that. And they prevent disease. And disease, again, is the moneymaker for pharmaceutical industry, right? You need something to treat if you want to have steady income.
Where in the world is the obvious solution to that? Some backup research in the public interest, profit or not?
Most of the development and production and distribution of vaccines has been done in the public sector around the world. And many countries, including ours, had a fairly robust public sector vaccine program for many years, which has over the years and with kind of the prevailing economic logic of the day become more and more privatized. There are still a few places in the world that do most drug development and production in the public sector. Cuba is certainly the biggest example of an entirely public system, and they've cranked out some new vaccines, you know, first cancer vaccine in the world and several others. And they've even got one of the medications that's now being tested as a possible treatment for coronavirus. So it certainly can be done.
Dana Brown, look very specifically at Operation Warp Speed. What's right, what's troublesome, but specifically this massive, almost open door federal financing, a political deadline, which complicates things enormously, a global problem. What is the model here that you're seeing?
Vaccine development requires a massive upfront public investment. The public sector is best placed to put up what we think of as patient capital, right? A big amounts of money that can be invested over a period of time that aren't expecting immediate returns, right? That's actually how vaccine development works. As you say, the complication is here, there's a political, you know, deadline, and there are other factors at play trying to speed up the process. The biggest way to speed it up would actually be to change the conditions here and say, you can only get public funds for this if you're going to share your data. Right now, we have billions of public dollars going into private corporations with little to no public interest provisions on that money. And these companies, some of which have never brought a product to market, and whose vaccine candidates rely on mountains of publicly funded research, they're being allowed to work in secrecy.
Including Moderna, if I get the story right.
Yes.
They've not brought a product yet.
Yes, that's correct. And there are other companies which have received public funds here and even, you know, bought and sold licenses in this process. and that have shown that they're very good at making money, which is what they're set up to do, right? These are highly financialized corporations that are good at making returns for shareholders. But transparency and collective learning about this virus is the single most important thing on the planet, right? Yeah. More people will die and we will have less information about what's the best way to treat the disease until we're sharing information and learning, right?
But Dana, has that point even been raised that given the gigantic public investment in a global crisis, that we'll suspend the patenting of whatever we find here? This is everybody's universal interest.
One of the problems with patents and other forms of intellectual property in this sector is that companies amass a lot of it and do what we think of as defensive patenting. They'll often amass hundreds of patents on a single medication. And sometimes these companies are sitting on kind of a treasure trove of IP, and that makes it harder for others to access that information and build off of it. There's coronavirus research that's been done in the past. Because there are antiviral medications that have been used in other diseases that might be helpful here, they're all already kind of cordoned off under a bunch of intellectual property, and researchers can't access them without paying a lot of money to license them.
Carl Zimmer in the New York Times runs a sort of, it's like a racing form, but a chart of roughly 100 companies that are working on a COVID vaccine. Is it possible that any one of those companies that crossed the finish line first would be setting the rules, the production levels, the price, let's not forget, of the cure for COVID-19?
Yes. And an extraordinarily important thing to note is that many contracts are already in place. So the United States, various countries in Europe, the UK, most of the sort of quote-unquote first world countries, right, the industrialized nations, have already entered into contracts with a lot of these companies that are producing vaccine candidates. So there are pre-purchase agreements to purchase a certain number of doses of the vaccine if and when it becomes available. And essentially, the whole market for the future COVID vaccine is already bought up by the first world.
How did we get here, Dana Brown? You make the point that tremendous advances in vaccines were sponsored by the United States Army in an atmosphere of relative openness. There was the famous moment when Ed Morrow asked Jonas Salk, who has the patent on your polio vaccine? And he said, what patent? He said, you can't patent the sun. We didn't always think the way we do. Now, how did we get here?
You know, until the mid-20th century, it's not how things worked, even here in the United States. There was kind of a big line in the sand, if you will, between what we considered ethical pharmacists and snake oil salesmen, right? And if you were a doctor or a pharmacist and you thought to claim intellectual property rights or build a market for your product, you were really associated with the fraudsters and the greedy posers, right? It was really not until kind of the Nixon era that the prevailing economic thought of the day kind of took hold of this industry. And then it really took off worldwide as we began, as the United States began to impose certain intellectual property protections, particularly for medicines, in our trade agreements with other countries. So places like India and China as well, which used to have a very different way of treating the intellectual property on medicines and chemicals and medical goods, were kind of forced, if they wanted to play in the same global market as we did, to impose more restrictions and to make it easier for companies to monopolize publicly funded work.
In the real world that's unfolding day to day here in a rush in 2020, Dana, what is the history that's actually being written in front of our eyes?
Competition, secrecy, and profit before people. You know, one of the arguments for developing a robust public sector pharmaceutical industry is that you're breaking your dependence on the private sector for everything, right? You suddenly have negotiating power that you didn't have if, you know, Eli Lilly isn't the only place you can go for insulin, for instance.
The insulin connection intrigues me. Is Eli Lilly the only producer?
There are three main producers of insulin in the world. But, you know, insulin's a very interesting case because it's a class of drugs that was developed in the public sector, in a public lab in Toronto, Canada. And the discoverers, the inventors of, you know, insulin as a medical product sold their patents in the United States because they thought it would help make it more available to more people. They thought they needed the industry to produce insulin. And though insulin was discovered almost 100 years ago in this public lab, it is now treated as a private good. And you have American diabetics dying from insulin rationing because they can't afford to buy back this public product. Hmm.
What is the alternative system, including some sort of public option?
I like to summarize it as kind of reclaiming medicine as a public good. Historically, even in the United States, we really did treat medicine and medications as a sort of public good, right? It's good for you if I get vaccinated. And what we need to do is just reclaim that and say that social value and the economic value there is more important than the value to any particular company or individual inventor. That certainly includes public actors doing research and development. It could also include nonprofits, and it could include states or even municipalities developing and producing generic medications, distributing them at cost. It's really more about the mindset. It's about thinking of medicine as public service rather than as a commodity.
That was Dana Brown of the Next Systems Project. Coming up, the rules of intellectual property in drugs and vaccine development. Who gets to own the cure and why? This is Open Source. Alexander Zaitchik, based in New Orleans, could have been an immunologist or a rich investor by now, but he remains an unusually studious public interest reporter, writing long takeouts in the New Republic and elsewhere. He's come to the view that the big mistake in the horse race to a COVID vaccine is that we think or pretend to think it's a competitive struggle of each horse and each rider against the field.
Why do we have all of these horses using public funds galloping in their own lane? We're much more likely to have that miracle that everyone is waiting for and that we're paying for to the tune of many billions of dollars in government funds if those horses are pulling the same plow, so to speak, and we had a more collaborative, open science approach, which was not running on the same old lines of intellectual property and proprietary science that has led to crises of access and under-researched critical areas around the world. We know this model has limits. Why did we adopt this model for this unprecedented public health emergency?
What is wrong with the patent regime and the idea of cures as intellectual property?
Well, patents are one aspect of a larger category known as intellectual property, which also includes research data, trade secrets, things that can either obstruct or facilitate and accelerate global research projects like the one currently investigating COVID. That inhibits research, but also it slows down tech transfer when we're actually at the stage where we need to build the manufacturing capabilities to make the thing. You know, around the world, we're going to need a whole lot of scale up. And it obstructs the distribution because we have companies who are not being transparent and they may be putting out price points that do not allow middle-income or low-income countries to have wide access. So across the board, intellectual property is a retardant to this project that the whole world should be working on as a team. And there was, at the beginning of the pandemic, a moment, quite an extended moment actually, where it seemed we might break in the other direction and put intellectual property to the side and have a more open science approach to this. There's an institution that exists. Not many people know about it, but the World Health Organization has a COVID technology access pool that about 40 countries have signed up to. None of the major vaccine production countries have, but it exists, and it represents a counterpoint and an alternative model, road not taken. It doesn't get a lot of attention in this country. I mean, when people hear about intellectual property and COVID, it's usually in the context of spies taking our precious research in this almost strange Lovian kind of contest that makes no sense in the context of a global pandemic. it gets very little attention. And one of the reasons is, of course, the United States immediately started talking about vaccine in terms of vaccine nationalism. We're going to buy up the supply, et cetera. That put the world on notice that this was every man for itself. It's worth noting that Bill Gates did not help matters very early on. His organization said IP is not an issue. We can continue with business as usual and we'll be able to kind of square the circle.
Business as usual suggests to me the intellectual property regime, the patent model, which has favored blockbuster drugs and very, very popular common drugs like, you name it, the statins, for example, that a lot of people take every day and they go on forever. Vaccines, on the contrary, have been underfunded partly because you don't take them all your life and the return is not guaranteed. But what else does the old model include that Bill Gates was reinforcing?
Basically, he was reinforcing the idea that IP alone is a spur to innovation. And it's ironic because he knows better than anyone else that that is absolutely not true, especially when it comes to vaccines. There has been an under and de-investment in vaccines on the part of the private sector that has been steady and increasing since the 1970s. So for them now to turn around and say, we need to maintain IP rights on an area that we have been ignoring, and we're receiving billions of dollars in government money right now is, you know, ironic, to put it mildly. They have been focusing on moneymakers, and even those drugs that return enormous profits, there are still access issues. So their arguments, I think, for business as usual in this case are very weak.
If they had turned a big page on intellectual property, Alex, spell out the difference.
There are a couple of things that happened at the beginning of this pandemic that sort of hinted at what an open science model would have looked like. China, for example, once it finally acknowledged the problem, shared the genetic sequence of this thing immediately with the world. Particle accelerators around the world run by national laboratories, these very expensive state-of-the-art centers, mapped the proteins at an atomic level, shared that information around the world. Everyone had access to it. And then people started to close ranks. Governments, corporations, everyone had their own horse in the race. And now we're trying to come to terms with the same old issues that have marred other research efforts. I mean, this is not a new problem. I mean, when HIV drugs were finally discovered in the late 90s and we had to scale up access, it took a long time because of IP rights. And we don't want to have the same problems with a COVID vaccine when hopefully one is available in the future.
Alex, how do you measure the day-to-day progress or course of this race? People do follow it. It's followed avidly on stock pages and in the pharmaceutical trade dailies. But how do you follow it?
I follow it through the same lens, but from the other side. I'll look at Moderna, but I'll look at the way that they have been non-transparent. They were recently caught, for example, hiding a BARDA grant related to their research. And the reason they didn't want to include that grant as part of one of their patent applications is because it would have possibly limited their right to profit from that patent.
Really?
Because the government, when it funds science, has claims on that science through public interest mechanisms written into U.S. law and patent code. And I'm watching very closely to see how the industry, even as it receives billions of dollars and is being subsidized for research that it otherwise would not likely be doing, is still trying to game the system against the American people, against the government that is underwriting their business model. And the fact that it's happening even now in the midst of this pandemic, it's a chance for us to really shine a light on it and move past this arrangement.
But would not Washington still, in any event, have the right to suspend patent protection of a vaccine that the whole world and this country needed desperately?
Yeah, it has that power over any drug, any medicine. Biden has said that any eventual vaccine would be shared. But, you know, there's been a lot of rhetoric on the part of companies and governments about making the vaccine a global public good. And the rhetoric, quite frankly, is pretty cheap. The real move is signing on to the WHO technology access pool, for example. And none of the major countries have done that.
Alex Etcher, you've written in the past, as a sort of general heads up to your readers and citizens, that the pharmaceutical and biotech industries in general were built to serve Wall Street and shareholder value more than to serve human needs and public health. That's a broad condemnation. Is it still true?
it's hard to read the data any other way. I mean, if you look at what these companies are doing with their profits, which are some of the largest margins in the economy, they're getting massive payouts, stock buybacks, declining R&D. You know, this is basically become not just a creature of Wall Street, but increasingly a creature of hedge funds and the most predatory financial actors in the economy. And, you know, there's been some great research on this by William Lozonik and others that I would recommend. But there's really no way around that conclusion at this point. The innovation argument that they need these profits just does not hold up when you look at what they're doing with their money. And that's before even getting to the fact that they're some of the biggest tax dodgers in the world, and they store not just their profits abroad, but also their IP, which is the beneficiary of enormous amounts of government money, as mentioned.
You would have changed that for the COVID era. Is anybody changing it on their own?
There are some companies that are sharing information between themselves. There's also a group of IP lawyers that is calling for sharing all information related to COVID research. There's a few companies that have signed up to an open IP pledge, including some big ones, IBM, Amazon, I think Intel. But again, these are not companies who are driving research into vaccines, diagnostics, therapeutics, so it's easy for them to do that. But in terms of the big players, they're hewing pretty close to the traditional model so far.
Alex, you've written about a golden age in this field, immunology and biology, in our lifetimes, from the mid-century on, World War II on, I suppose, and an incredible string of successes in finding the answer, the vaccine answer to smallpox and rubella and measles and all manner of things. What made that possible? And what happened to the system that seemed so incredibly productive?
Yeah, it's fascinating to think that all of that was within memory for a lot of people. That regime grew out of World War II and the Office of Scientific Research and Development, in which the government emerged as the number one funder of biomedical research and development. And that carried through into the post-war period. And as you mentioned, there were a lot of vaccines that came out of it. Industrial penicillin came out of it. That world was defined by two things that are no longer existent as we would need them to be and hope them to be. And one of them is sustained government focus on these issues. They pick a target and they keep the money flowing into it. And two is not handing off exclusive rights to partners in industry. They maintained a claim, and that claim was weakened steadily from the end of World War II into the Reagan era, when they were pretty much completely relinquished with Bayh-Dole and a couple other pieces of legislation that basically allowed a full cannibalization on the part of industry of government-funded science and related inventions.
Bayh-Dole was actually Jimmy Carter time, as I remember, 1980, pre-Reagan. But then under Reagan and afterward, all of these patent rights seemed to have been written into our trade policy so that there was a sort of worldwide patent in effect on the drug breakthroughs in the United States. How did that figure?
Well, yeah, after the U.S. adopted this new neoliberal approach to intellectual property, especially with regard to medicines, but in a number of areas, just IP generally, it then globalized that new regime through the World Trade Organization and bilateral trade deals and various forms of pressure that the U.S. could apply at the height of its power in the post-Cold War period. But the World Trade Organization was the main venue for that and is now the main venue for pushing back against that regime. That's where a group of nations led by South Africa are pushing very hard to expand some exceptions to that regime that exists, that were, you know, fought for, but do exist in WTO policy. So it was a process that has been ongoing. The U.S. Trade Representative continues to push for very strict enforcement of IP protection on drug companies, U.S. And other drug companies. And if you push back, for example, if you're a state that forces compulsory licensing to lower drug prices in India, Brazil, various countries have done this over the years, there are usually high prices to pay, and the U.S. government tries to, you know, make you feel some pain as a way to also deflect other countries from attempting something similar. And the pushback never stopped. This pushback is ongoing. This is a constant fight that happens, you know, mostly off the front page of the U.S. media. The WHO technology pool is an example of that. you know, it's something we don't know about, but in much of the world, it's a big discussion because much of the world has a much more direct experience with these issues, especially related to HIV medications, which, you know, before they were widely available in the developing world, millions of people died after their emergence unnecessarily.
Speak of the technology pool.
Well, it basically is exactly what it sounds like. All countries would pool their research related to vaccines, diagnostics, and treatments. The research would be there for everyone to inspect, to use, to collaborate on, and the resultant technologies would be available on a non-exclusionary basis. Anybody could produce them without having to go through IP hurdles. The tech transfer could begin at any stage without having to do these endless negotiations. We're already dealing with these negotiations that are taking way longer than they would have without IP, because suddenly you've got all these lawyers involved and there's terms and there's restrictions and it just slows everything down. I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
COVID time seems to us an entirely new era. In less than 100 days, this virus enveloped the whole planet. You'd think the idea of national competition or America first or Tanzania first or China first would be almost a joke by now. Who's missing the point about the absolutely common disaster here?
I think you have to start with the rich countries who are pouring money into the research, and then you have to move pretty quickly to Bill Gates. I mean, he is the most influential character in global public health policy in the vaccine research world, and he is very influential. His organizations call a lot of shots. They're the biggest funder in the World Health Organization. So I'm not sure exactly what he could have done if he had decided to back the WHO technology pool. Maybe we'd be having a very different discussion right now. Maybe not. Any discussion about government policies have to include Bill Gates on this issue.
And is it mainly around the intellectual property issue, that I can own your cure?
Yeah, I mean, Bill Gates made his money in IP, and he continues, even though he knows very intimately the problems of IP with research and development and access in the field of vaccines, he continues to back IP equals innovation, that traditional, you know, assumption and argument, which has been, I think, at this point, pretty well discounted. And his own organizations are examples of that. The Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations is an organization funded by governments and philanthropy, and it's basically Bill Gates' organization. And he is trying to spur research into areas that are not traditionally profitable, including mystery pandemics like COVID-19 turned out to be. Gavi is a vaccine alliance that attempts to use market mechanisms to ensure access for the developing world. But it does so, both of these organizations do their work, which, you know, admittedly is important, without challenging the basis of the system that resulted in this failure in the first place. So a lot of people who work in this area, if you talk to medicines access activists, they'll say Gates, while trying to be the solution, is ending up being part of the problem. And we really need to move beyond the IP model that is reinforced by CEPI and Gavi if we're going to get to a place where we want to be with pandemics and vaccines.
In general, Alex, I could feel, looking at the vaccine race, that we're seeing a sort of version of the whole COVID lesson, which was that we don't have a public health system in this country. We don't have a public health mentality either.
Yeah, I think this is part of a society-wide problem. And it's about the loss of an idea of a common weal and a public good, and the idea that we're all in this together and there are values beyond not just profit, but again, these are obscene profits. I mean, these companies are printing money, the major pharmaceutical companies. They have exclusive rights on the ultimate inelastic market, which is life-saving medicines. I mean, how did we let this happen?
It's funny to watch a horse race with a skeptic, but it's good for us, Alex Zajcik. And I thank you very, very much for the hard work you've done for months and months now on this story.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Chris. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dana Brown, Rebecca Weintraub, Jerry Avorn, and Aaron Kesselheim. You can support Open Source by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon, where you'll find extras like Adam Coleman's ongoing series of interviews about storytelling in a time of social distance. This week, he's talking Balzac novels with Peter Brooks. Find the conversation at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. Mike Garth engineered. Mary McGrath is our chief medical officer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.